Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to protecting, educating, and promoting Florida's hospitality industry. Over 10,000 members providing 1.4 million jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. More at frla.org. And from Florida Wildlife Federation, a private nonprofit conservation organization working on behalf of Florida's fish, wildlife, and their habitats, as well as outdoor education and sustainable nature-based recreation. Florida Wildlife Federation, since 1936, fwfonline.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
An unexpected federal windfall relieves some of the budget pressure at the Florida Capitol.
Florida has always been shortchanged on the amount of LIF funding that we've gotten, particularly compared to states like Texas. And so this is very significant.
Also tonight, House lawmakers want to pour money into a teacher bonus program, but others have different ideas.
Why have we decided in this budget in the House to expand it exponentially when others are recommending the opposite?
We'll also get the latest on juvenile justice reform, the war on human trafficking, efforts to ban fracking in Florida, and sit in on the latest public meeting of the state's Constitution Revision Commission. I'm Tom Flanagan. During a week shortened by the Passover and Easter observances, Florida lawmakers race to pack 5 days of work into two. This is Capitol Report. Florida's getting a big budget break in the form of $1.5 billion in supplemental health care payments from the federal government. And as Lynn Hatter reports, hospitals are breathing a sigh of relief.
Low-income pool funding supports hospitals and other health providers for the care of uninsured and underinsured patients. Under the Obama administration, the money was phased out after Florida refused to expand Medicaid to more low-income Floridians. The dollars officially ran out last year. But the Senate wrote in $600 million in LIP funding in the hope the federal government would give the money back. The House did not include those funds. Wednesday, Governor Rick Scott, state and federal health officials announced Florida would get that and then some.
Obviously, we think it is encouraging that that the Scott administration and the Trump administration worked very quickly to get to a point where, you know, they could offer some certainty to the legislature in terms of the availability of these funds.
Bruce Rubin heads the Florida Hospital Association. Hospitals had been facing big cuts under the Florida Senate and House budget proposals, some $200 to $600 million in cuts between the two chambers. Rubin hopes the influx of new federal LIP money will offset those proposals.
Because now the House and the Senate can make informed decisions about the budget.
So I think it's too early to determine how exactly we would appropriate that money or deploy that money. But it's great news. Florida has always been shortchanged on the amount of LIP funding that we've gotten, particularly compared to states like Texas. And so this is very significant.
That's Senate President Joe Negron. At its peak in 2014, the low-income pool was worth more than $2 billion, with money coming from both the state and federal government. This year's funding is a combination of both as well, with $500 million slated to come from local governments and the rest from the federal government, amounting to a $1.5 billion LIP pool. Agency for Healthcare Administration Secretary Justin Senior notes that's historically what the federal government has given to Florida.
And so the traditional LIP has been $1 billion, now it's 1.5.
The state and federal government are still ironing out the details for how the LIP money gets spent. Senior suggests it could be used to help a group of low-income Floridians who make too much money for Medicaid. Right now, the state only pays hospital bills in the medically needy program.
And you can't help but think that there's a possibility of expanding more comprehensive coverage to those individuals, that it would allow them to establish a primary care physician and to improve the coordination of their coverage so that they weren't simply reliant on a crisis setting, very expensive back-end setting. And there's a possibility, I think, to do that for folks below the poverty level, for example, in those income and eligibility categories.
But that's not to be confused with expanding Medicaid, which the state continues to reject. Senior says another idea up for negotiation is how the LIT money is distributed to healthcare providers. He floats the idea of creating a tiered priority system for reimbursements based on how much charity care organizations provide. But he notes local governments need to be guaranteed a certain amount of money in order for them to continue giving to the program. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Florida hospitals aren't the only things that may be getting a bit extra money after this session. The Florida House has approved a plan to give bonuses to teachers and principals. Nick Evans reports critics take issue with handing out money based on test scores that are sometimes decades old.
Since 2015, Florida has given out bonuses to teachers under the Best and Brightest program. To be eligible, teachers must be rated highly effective in the classroom and score within the 80th percentile on a standardized test like the SAT. In each of the last 2 years, state lawmakers have appropriated about $50 million for the program. But this year, Miami Republican Representative Manny Diaz wants to make a bigger splash.
This amendment conforms to the proposed House General Appropriations Act, which includes a $200 million additional funds for the Best and Brightest Teacher and Principal Scholarship Program. It also changes the eligibility criteria to the 77th percentile for the exams listed in the bill.
The changes would more than quadruple the money lawmakers have devoted to the program in prior years, expand eligibility to more teachers, and for the first time include principals. This week, lawmakers began hashing the plan out on the House floor. And many Democrats aren't too thrilled with the idea.
Looking at the provisions, are we not concerned that this will compromise our evaluation, the integrity of our evaluation system for our principals?
That's Miami Democrat Chevron Jones. Principals are eligible for a bonus based on how many best and brightest teachers they employ. But some worry Diaz's bill could encourage administrators to cook the books, because part of a teacher's eligibility could be tied to classroom evaluations. Diaz sidestepped the question. Orlando Democratic Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith raises another longstanding complaint.
Is it still the case that with this scholarship program, that a teacher can qualify for the Best and Brightest scholarship based on an SAT or SAT exam they perhaps took 25 years ago?
It is still the case. Diaz's bill also expands the range of eligible tests to include postgraduate exams like the GRE or LSAT and lowers the qualification benchmark to the 77th percentile. Smith raises another point, too.
The Senate budget, the governor's budget, as well as the State Board of Education, have all recommended that we slash some of the funding for this scholarship. Why have we decided in this budget in the House to expand it exponentially when others are recommending the opposite?
But according to Senator David Simmons, his chamber is ready to deal. The Altamonte Springs Republican chairs the Senate Budget Committee for Pre-K to 12 Education.
At this time, we do not have a best and brightest allocation that is within this budget. However, we do contemplate working with our colleagues in the House to expand the best and brightest program.
Lawmakers are planning to start budget negotiations in the coming week. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Efforts to put the brakes on Florida's no-fault auto insurance system are moving in both the House and Senate, but with a little more than 3 weeks remaining in the 60-day legislative session, and critics claiming the change would be a boon to trial lawyers and kill small business jobs, the proposal is just starting to advance in the Senate. Today, the Senate Banking and Insurance Committee voted to support a measure that would do away with the no-fault system and the requirement that motorists carry personal injury protection, commonly referred to as PIP coverage. The bill would require motorists to buy bodily injury coverage, which most drivers in Florida already have. A short time later, the House Commerce Committee voted to back a repeal measure that would impose a different minimum of bodily injury coverage. That bill is now ready to go to the full House. Under the decades-old no-fault system, motorists are required to carry $10,000 in personal injury protection coverage, and that coverage, which essentially hasn't changed since 1979, is designed to pay medical bills after accidents. The House legislation, sponsored by Representative Aaron Grawl, is projected projected to save motorists an average of about $81 a year per policy. The house savings are mostly due to the fact that nearly 90% of motorists already have some form of bodily injury coverage, and the amount saved would depend on where motorists live. The Senate plan, which would require more overall coverage and gradually impose a higher minimum bodily injury coverage, is projected to provide $9 to $12 a year in savings, again, depending on where motorists live. Still to come on Capitol Report, the Senate President's prized juvenile justice bill is ready for a floor vote, but with the legislative session on the brink of winding down, some controversial amendments are hitching a ride on the plan.
We're at the point in session where different bills may not be fully moving along the process, and so this is an opportunity for several senators' issues to be brought together.
We'll hear the latest on a bill intending to build on past efforts to combat human trafficking.
The violent sexual history was carried out repeatedly. This settled claims bill would hopefully go a small way in helping make that right.
A desperate attempt to ban fracking in Florida may not be able to overcome a legislative logjam.
We've got the science on our side, we've got common sense on our side, and we've got the will of the people certainly on our side.
And Florida's Constitution Revision Commission holds a public meeting nearly in the shadow of the state capitol. Citizens spoke about everything from restoring felons' voting rights to preserving abortion rights.
There is nothing more fundamental to a woman's private life than the right to decide the most intimate, personal, and difficult decision of whether or not to carry a pregnancy to term.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
A top priority of Florida's Senate president is now ready for a floor vote, but after some political maneuvering, the bill also contains a controversial amendment targeting the state's Supreme Court. Kate Payne reports the change could challenge lawmakers' loyalties.
Florida lawmakers want to change how young people are punished for low-level offenses. If senators get their way, trespassing and possession of alcohol or small amounts of pot would result in a ticket instead of jail time. Here's bill sponsor Anna Terry Flores, a Miami Republican.
The law enforcement officer would be required to have issue a civil citation rather than have them go into the adult court system or even to the juvenile justice system.
Local officers and deputies are already issuing tickets for certain misdemeanors if it's a first-time offense. Rusty May is a reverend in Fort Myers. He says these programs are a second chance for offenders who then
apologize to the victim, the officer, and those affected by their actions. Meet with community impact panels and learn life skills. Are referred to counseling or alcohol drug treatment programs when called for. And conversely, if they go to jail, these character-building actions rarely take place.
But because the program is voluntary, it can vary from county to county or even officer to officer, which is why Flores wants to make civil citations mandatory.
If every county was like Pinellas County and had a 90%, in some years it's as high as 94% of civil citation, we wouldn't have to be doing this bill. We wouldn't.
Steve Kinsey is the undersheriff in Broward County. Since 2012, his department has mandated civil citations, and he says the program is reducing recidivism and preventing officer bias.
Sending them to the juvenile detention centers, they come out better criminals in most cases, and they learn to be better car burglars. But we've shown that putting them in this program and making it mandatory and taking that discretion away from our deputies allows them not to put any personal bias into it.
The benefits are clear: less jail time and fewer criminal records for young people. But St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis believes there are cases when an officer should be able to make the call.
I appreciate everything in this bill except for one word, and that is the shall, where I believe it should be may. And I appreciate the sheriff from Broward's comments about what his local department does. But I don't believe that we should take discretion away from law enforcement.
Something else is giving lawmakers pause as well. Thursday, Flores added a controversial judicial reform to the bill.
The Florida Supreme Court has to provide an annual report regarding information about cases on the court's docket that the court has not resolved within 180 days. The court also has to include information about cases decided by the court, but that a decision was not rendered within 180 days.
Basically, lawmakers think the court isn't turning cases fast enough, and they want more data. Opponents say it's part of a concerted effort to erode the independence of the judiciary. It's a top priority for House leadership, but it's been losing momentum in the Senate. Flores is pretty frank about the move.
We're at the point in session where different bills may not be fully moving along the process. And so this is an opportunity for several senators' issues to be brought together. It's a good way to have even more support for this very good bill.
The civil citations bill has been slowing down in the House, and Flores is hopeful her colleagues will come around. Back in her own chamber, neither the law enforcement mandate nor the reporting requirements were enough to derail the bill. It now heads to the Senate floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Several claims bills which found Florida's child welfare agency at fault are now heading to the House floor. As Sasha Cordner reports, among them is a high-profile bill involving twins that further compensates the surviving victim in an abuse case that took his twin sister's life.
For the past few years, Miami Republican Representative Jose Felix Diaz has been filing a claims bill in the House for Victor Barahona. He and his twin sister, Nubia, were abused by their foster parents who later adopted them. This was all while under the supervision of the Florida Department of Children and Families. Their case later led to a legislative overhaul of Florida's child welfare system. In the past, though, the Barahona claims bill usually went nowhere in the legislature, but now it's already headed to the Senate floor, and Thursday it passed its final stop in the House Judiciary Committee, sending it on to the full chamber.
Hopefully I get this one across the finish line. And for the freshmen, just know that, you know, just because it doesn't pass the first 4 years doesn't mean it might not pass in year five or six.
Diaz says he's hopeful this goes all the way because it's such a tragic case.
Over the years, they were tortured. They were subjected to all sorts of abuse, mental and physical, sexual, and ultimately DCF dropped the ball quite a few times, and the sister ended up dead, and the brother ended up almost dead in the back of a truck doused in chemicals. And he's lived to tell the tale.
DCF was found to be negligent after ignoring red flags and calls to their abuse hotline about the kids. And Diaz adds the agency is not contesting the claim.
The Department of Children and Families agreed to pay $5 million. They've already paid $1.25 million. They now owe $3.75 million.
A change to the bills now states the funds must be paid over a two-year period instead of a single year. Another claims bill by Orlando Republican Representative Mike Miller has been filed since 2010. It creates a trust for Letitia Thomas to receive $800,000. DCF already paid her $200,000.
Letitia Thomas was removed from her home at 14 months old and placed in a foster home by DCF. 2 years later, her foster father pleaded no contest to sex crimes with a 13-year-old, and yet DCF allowed Ms. Thomas to remain in the home for another 8 years. He went on to sexually abuse her until she ran away and sought protection of law enforcement. The good news, Mr. Chairman, is she's now 21 years old and in college to become a therapist and would like to specialize in treating traumatized children.
Another uncontested claims bill is sponsored by Tampa Republican Representative James Grant. In this case, DCF was found to have 50% of the blame for knowingly placing an abused child known to be abusive towards other kids in the care of foster parents with children of their own.
That foster child had a serially documented sexually violent history. That foster child then did the worst of the worst to the children of the natural born parents. This is a claims bill in the amount of $5,076,000, members. There are zero lobbying fees, and the maximum attorney fees under the existing rules are $1.269 million.
And after passing their last committee Thursday, all three bills will now be taken up by the full House. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Once past the halfway point, the lifting tends to get even heavier in the Florida legislature as various measures that may have looked like a slam dunk early on start getting bogged down. Here's a classic example of that. Environmentalists are making a last-ditch attempt to impose a statewide fracking ban in Florida. But as Jim Ash reports, breaking a legislative logjam won't be easy.
It's the halfway point of the 2017 legislative session, and the environmentalists are no longer smiling. The same advocates who were exchanging high fives on the opening day of session are now making a final stand on the Capitol Rotunda. Here's Florida Food and Water Watch's Brian Lee.
Over 50 cities and close to 40 counties have passed resolutions requesting that the Florida legislature ban fracking or passed ordinances banning fracking within their own jurisdictions.
And that's significant, Lee says.
Most Floridians live in a city or county that has taken this kind of action.
Industry experts insist the controversial oil and gas drilling method can be done safely in the Sunshine State, even with its porous limestone bedrock. But Sierra Club lobbyist David Cullen says there's far too little oil and gas in Florida to justify the risk. Besides, Cullen says, Florida's already reeling from the effects of climate change tied to fossil fuel use.
It's past time to leave the dirty fuel in the ground. The toxic chemicals, the spills, the leaks, and the emissions are not worth the risk. Move forward to energy efficiency and renewable energy, and Florida and the planet will be a better place.
Tampa Senator Dana Young raised hopes this summer when she promised to be the first Florida Republican to file a ban. Young is a former House Majority Leader, and her supporters were counting on her sway with her former colleagues. But despite widespread bipartisan support in her chamber, the bill stalled after its first committee vote. Predictably, the House never heard a companion measure, even though it was also filed by a Republican. Democratic Senator Gary Farmer of Fort Lauderdale is still refusing to give up.
We've got the science on our side. We've got common sense on our side. And we've got the will of the people certainly on our side. And all those points come together in the common ground that fracking is not a good idea in the state of Florida.
And Farmer isn't above begging.
And so calling on the chairs of the respective committees to please do whatever you can, find the time on your committee agendas, please, please hear these bills.
House Majority Leader Ray Rodriguez of Fort Myers is the biggest stumbling block in that chamber. His refusal to let the bill move set up a familiar dynamic. Now, the chairman of the committee where Young's bill is supposed to go next is also refusing to hear it. Fleming Island Republican Rob Bradley sees no reason, even though he voted for the measure at its first stop.
I make it a practice as a committee chair to not hear bills just for the heck of it. And if the House is not moving on a bill, then I see no reason to spend the valuable time of my colleagues hearing a bill that isn't going anywhere.
Ever the optimist, Florida conservation voters Aliki Moncrief says Senate leaders could get the ball back in motion. With nearly half the Senate co-sponsoring the legislation, Moncrief says it just takes one more vote.
So I think if the Senate demonstrates that this can move, that creates opportunities for the House to then pick up the baton.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, Florida's Constitution Revision Commission is taking public comments as it prepares to craft possible changes to the state's fundamental document. Members are hearing a lot from Floridians about access to abortion services and restoring voting rights for felons who have served their time, as we hear from Sarah Mueller.
The Constitutional Revision Commission drew more than 100 people to Florida A&M University Wednesday evening. Attendees spoke about abortion access and voting rights for felons. The state's on its sixth constitution, which was enacted in 1968. Tallahassee resident Regina Sheridan says she wants the commission to propose less government interference with her right to make her own decision.
There is nothing more fundamental to a woman's private life than the right to decide the most intimate, personal and difficult decision of whether or not to carry a pregnancy to term.
But Tallahassee resident Chase Cohey says Florida should defend the health care rights of adult women and those of unborn children. He wants the state to restrict abortion.
And abortion is the most restrictive, the greatest restriction to public access, because it takes away the right to life from men and women. So I am concerned about women's rights. I'm also concerned about the women's rights of the unborn women.
CRC Chairman Carlos Baruff says people all over the state have voiced concerns on both sides of the abortion issue.
Well, we've got a variety of things that keep coming up, the Article 1, Section 3, but, you know, the important thing is that we're allowing anybody to come up and talk to us. And some of the ideas that we get aren't as well defined. But at the end of the day, that's why we're having the public process. We want everybody to come talk to us.
Several speakers asked the commission to allow automatic restoration of felons' voting rights. More than 1.5 million people in Florida can't vote. Governor Rick Scott and the Clemency Board reversed the state's automatic restoration process when he took office in 2011. Mark Schlackman with the Florida State University's Center for Human Rights says too few people are getting their voting rights back. He says about 66,000 people a year complete their felony sentences, but only about 2,600 people have regained their right to vote since Scott took office.
Florida has, at least research indicates, more than 25% of all of those who are disenfranchised by way of felony disenfranchisement throughout the United States. And it currently has among the more restrictive procedures.
A lawsuit filed last month accuses Scott and other members of the Florida Clemency Board of denying voting rights to felons who have completed their sentences because of traffic tickets or admitted uses of drugs or alcohol. Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi is on the Constitutional Revision Commission and the Clemency Board. She's also named in the suit. Bondi says the board doesn't deny someone for traffic tickets unless they've racked up around 100 citations.
I think a lot of the commissioners, I think you're referring to, sometimes ask about multiple traffic tickets, a couple in particular. But I think there's a lot of information as well that's confidential that they can't discuss with the public.
Other issues commissioners hear about include water quality, fracking, and energy conservation. A few participants are also calling for an independent redistricting commission and open primaries. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and please join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2017 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to protecting, educating, and promoting Florida's hospitality industry. Over 10,000 members providing 1.4 million jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. More at frla.org. And from the Florida Wildlife Federation, supporting acquisition, protection, and stewardship of public and private conservation lands to protect Florida's waters, and to Everglades Restoration and Fish and Wildlife Conservation, the Florida Wildlife Federation, fwfonline.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.